Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. We have Stephen Rowley, who is an author, a psychotherapist, has a PhD from Stanford in education, and has spent 40 years in education. Stephen is the author of this book, The Lost Coin, which I have read. I thoroughly enjoyed it and recommend it. And welcome, Stephen. Yes, it's great to see you. So this is going to be fun because there's so much to talk about. And here's a quote. So Stephen, you want to just give the audience any kind of background so they can have a context for our conversation besides what I've said?
Well, really briefly, the book is on one level, the search for my birth parents. I was adopted, and it took me half my life up to age 40 to find my birth mother. And not in almost 2 years to the day, through 23andMe, the name of my birth father came to me, and then as did his my four half sisters, his own daughters. He's been deceased for some time. So that's one track. The other is that the book is more than about my adoption and the longing and the searching for that sense of identity. But all the other things that happened to me as somebody who was born in the late 1940s and growing up in the 50s and 60s and going through radical college days and end up in, you know, kind of making my way through all manner of different levels of public education, some of the highlights and lowlights of that. So there's a lot in this book beyond just adoption, but it does reinforce the idea that these have things seem to be fated in a way in our lives. We can't sometimes understand how and why, but this my adoption set the stage for me in terms of my overall destiny.
Yes. Now, one of the scenes that just came to me from the book was when you went to the baseball game with your grandfather.
Yes.
Why? I mean, obviously it was a special day. What is there anything that stands out for you as to why you put it in there? I mean, I can guess, but I'd rather hear it in your words.
I think that this first going on a cattle truck with my grandfather to the Chicago stockyards, and for the first time seeing thousands of animals being led to slaughter. We stayed there for a night or two. The food was great. As I was a 7-year-old kid, I thought that was pretty cool. But then we got on the L in downtown Chicago and made our way to Wrigley Field. And that was the first time I'd really seen, it wasn't the first time I'd seen black people, but it was the first time I saw large, sprawling urban decay and urban blight. It was, and also at that time, large numbers of African-American people, black people. And then ironically get to Wrigley Field and see the great Ernie Banks for the first time. So that encapsulates in a way kind of my own sort of very early initiation into kind of a formal way of saying it, class and race consciousness that got to me very early. And there's other like those kind of events that happened to me later when I was still quite young that let me see what not only the world was like, but as I grew into the awareness that I was adopted, realized that my upbringing was quite privileged. You know, I had great parents. My parents weren't super rich. My dad was a surgeon and so forth. Lived in a nice house across the street from the country club. Only later did I realize how lucky I was to have them, as opposed to the family of my birth mother, who I eventually met, and what an absolute train wreck of a family that was. So that's kind of that first, there's these layers of kind of peeling away how we become aware, how if we're lucky or if we are determined, how we begin to see life a little bit differently rather than the, you know, that I was in the bliss of a Leave It to Beaver world, which I never believed I was.
Okay.
All right, here's, I'm just going to skip around with my questions, but Jim March, tell me what is right about him.
About who?
About him, whoever you were talking about. I think you were going to maybe complain about someone, and he said, tell me what is right about him.
Oh, this is an advanced seminar with graduate seminar at Stanford in the School of Business with Professor Jim March, who was, anybody who was around at that time realized he was the penultimate of professors at Stanford. In the seminar, the first day I realized half the class was, it was a seminar of 24. Half of them already were postdocs from London School of Economics. I had only been teaching elementary school only a year and a half before that, so I was a little intimidated. But he gave two rules. One is to tell us what words you don't understand, and when it's your turn to be chosen, when it's your time to speak, when you're chosen on this random number generator, don't tell us what's wrong with the paper. Any jackass can do this. Tell us what's right. And believe me, that had a lot of people scrambling. I mean, because myself included, we had to be prepared every class for two, present two papers. We were scratching stuff about, and eventually we got it straight. But that kind of, and later he told me, when I asked him to be on my dissertation committee, he said, you're really good in class, which I was dumbfounded he would say that. I kind of looked puzzled, and he goes, yeah, he said, you only talked about what you knew. I said, I really respect that. And that was the greatest compliment I ever got at Stanford. So those kind of like, those gems of just common sense wisdom that for somebody like me just bore in and just stuck with me. So I was very lucky to have Jim and very lucky to be at Stanford.
I forgot. I thought he was talking about a person, but that's also like a really good thing to do. It's so easy to find what's wrong with people, but it's not as much of a habit to find what's right.
Jim taught a course, and later somebody made a movie of Jim about using Cervantes' Don Quixote as a tool for teaching leadership, which seems completely counter to it, since Quixote's just busted up all night, delusional, ridiculed in society, just looked like the big fool he was, and thought Dulcinea was the most beautiful woman in the world, and that wasn't true or anything. But there's the line from Cervantes is, yo sé quién soy. I know who I am. And Jim's point in teaching about leadership this way was that he, despite appearances, Quixote was dedicated to chivalry, to the romantic ideal of righting wrong, what we call social justice. And despite the fact he was ridiculed, he stayed that way to his death. And so that yo sé quién soy, I know who I am, that was, I think, something that Jim lived. And I think for somebody like me, it just bore home that as we don't get it in the beginning, we live into that truth. I know who I am. I may not know who I am, but I know what I am. I know that I know this is true about me. So that was an important lesson. There was a luncheon that when I graduated, this proves the point. I invited several professors I'd worked with. My family was there, including my aunt, who was managing our family farm. She was a retired school teacher back in Illinois, very plain, sharp as a tack. But, my girlfriend at the time was a tall, blonde Stanford grad, acting at ACT, brilliant. And so Jim's sitting between the two of them. And so he's talking to my girlfriend about Chekhov and Shakespeare. And to my aunt, Jim was from the Midwest and turned to her and started talking about the price of hogs in Illinois. And I was so taken with that. It was so easy. It was so simple. And yet that he could do both with such ease and which grace and made them both feel. And I remember at the moment, I thought in my mind, this is the guy I want to be. So that kind of something to shoot for, to be able to have, and I think the book does this in a way, keep your roots, keep your groundedness. Maybe that's my Midwestern sensibility, my Iowa sensibility, as well as the top end, all the theoretical stuff in both at Stanford and also in Jungian psychotherapy, which I'm in now today. So that keeps me grounded. And I think I'd like to think that shows through, but I had to learn those lessons along the way, even though they came to me in a very unexpected way.
And was that the aunt that you had a break with, that you used to live with them and then something happened?
No, I had a break with my mother, if that's what you're referring to. When I was 13, they always told me I was adopted. I never had a complaint about my parents. I had no reason to. But I asked them, I wanted to know more when I was 13, and my mother basically, you know, threw a gigantic hissy fit and said, "What's wrong with you? Don't you think we love you enough?" And I was so, angered and humiliated by that question, I just ran out of the room, up to my door, and slammed it, and swore to myself I would never ever talk to her about my adoption again. And I didn't. I never did. And she knew that I found my birth mother, and she knew I knew she knew that. We never had those words. Now, at the end of the book, there's a very different resolution to that rupture. It wasn't horrible. It's not like we didn't get along, or there was an edge to that. And but that's how that was that kind of driver for me. Like it was once she said you shouldn't or you can't, was that was my impetus to go do it. So it took going to college to be able to have a mailing address and start in the pre-internet days to write adoption agency and state records and to find my sealed records, and it was years later that I finally got my hands on them. So it was a lot of detective work, a lot of frustration, but eventually in the late 80s, when I came, the adoption agency director gave me a little piece of paper and said, maybe this will help you. This is not part of your sealed record. Gave me the name of my birth mother, the name and where she lived, as well as my birth father, not where he was from. So I went to her hometown. In the middle of the summer, you know, I walk in the small town library. I look like Jimmy Buffett. I got my thongs on, my short shorts, my Hawaiian shirt, and asked to see a yearbook from 1943. And heads turned like, what's this guy doing? When I finally got the book, and actually when I finally did find the page that was her, I knew it in a second. It's like, I'm looking at me. I was like, I am looking at me. So it was jaw-dropping, and soon after I think I stole a telephone book when I got back home. I lived in the Bay Area, and I wrote everybody in the county, that county and Iowa, that had the same last name, and said, for the purposes of a reunion, do you have the name and do you have the location of her name? And weeks went by, I got nothing. And one day I get this little piece of paper and it said her name or new married name and what town she was in. And I might've had an address. I think I had an address and that was it. So I wrote her a letter. Praise God, I kept a copy of that. And then when it came back to me, before anything came back to me in terms of letter, I got a phone call from one of my half sisters and said, we're not sure we can allow this to happen. We have to check with their psychiatrist. She just got out of a halfway house. And my response was, I'm coming anyway, even if it just means standing across the street to see her. So I did, eventually. I'm going to excuse myself one second.
Okay. Was the original response from your mother, or was it from her daughter, saying, I think I can help you find her? Wasn't that from someone else?
Well, at this stage, I was saying, one of my half sisters said, "Yeah, we'll meet you. Come, and one of us will take you to meet her." So we did. So even though she knew I was coming, the immediate reception was not so hot. It was like I'm standing there. It's a really dreary suburban, urban kind of low rent tenement apartment owned by the state. And she opened the door crack, and my half-sister was standing with me. I had only known her for a couple hours. And she opened the door crack and looked at me and said, who the hell gave you the right to? I didn't ask you to come. So my half-sister goes, what are you, Mom? What are you talking about? So finally I got in. I handed her some flowers, beautiful long-stem white roses in a box. And she kind of humped me and kind of glanced half my way and said, well, no one's ever given me flowers. So when I heard that, it was like, I could feel the heartache. Mm. So when she ushered me in and we made a little tense chit chat, and then I looked around and she said, well, you have to excuse me. A lot of my belongings haven't caught up with me yet. My books aren't here. I'm just sort of, well, how many books do you have? And she said, oh, about 500 or so. Light bulbs went off in my head when I heard that. I realized this is a woman who reads. Even though she was walking the streets only about a month before, like a bag lady. And then I noticed on the wall, there was a poster from the National Gallery. It was a Kandinsky. And I just made some blithe comment like, oh, I see you must like the National Gallery. She says, yeah, that one's the Kandinsky. Now, in 1938, that's just before he came over from from Russia into Switzerland or France, wherever it was. And then she gave me this recitation on Kandinsky. Just blew my mind. And so, but then later in the book, I won't go into it now, but there was the, when I made a joke and we both erupted at it. And at that moment, it was as though it was like a Spock mind meld. I could see into her soul. I could feel her come into me. I got her. My laughter was the same. We thought the same way, despite circumstances, despite the fact that I'm like, you know, Mr. Stanford PhD, and she's living in a pretty disheveled place, clean but disheveled. Our lives had gone totally different ways. But then I realized in an instant, she had been wanting to find me as much as I'd wanted to find her, and had been waiting as her other kids all been waiting for me to show up. I just finally did. And so to say that it was moving for both of us, is to say the least. So I was there for another, I went out and met one of my other half sisters and the following day. And then when I came back, she introduced me to her roommate as her son. And she said, look, you know, she said, you have a great mother and dad. There's no, I'm glad you do, but don't forget I'm still your mother too. And then I asked her, I said, you know, the question I didn't need to ask was, do you remember me on my birthday? And she stopped and said, well, of course I do. And that's when we both kind of broke down. So it was very, very moving. And then soon after that, when I left, I described the scene relatively briefly, hopefully from a literary point of view. Once we hugged goodbye, we stood holding each other for a long time. And I'm back out. It's cold and snowy and windy, and I made the way to our car. And I knew when I left that door, I'd never see her again, and I never did.
I thought you went back when she was dying, no?
No. That was my mother. That was my mom. But my birth mother. My birth mother, no, she died 2 years after I saw her. And it was not a surprise, but I felt we both had the same attitude about it. It was just the reunion of that mother and child reunion was it. We were back together acknowledging that. Now, the fast forward until about my birthday, about 6 weeks ago, February 10th, 2024, I was in Kansas City where I was born, and with a fellow historian of the Willis Maternity Sanatorium where I was born, which was the biggest home for unwed mothers in Kansas City at the time. We did two speeches. One was the Kansas City Library, and there were about the Willis Maternity Sanatorium was the place to be. And over the decades, there were about 30,000 of us that were born there. And the library is only about 2 miles from where the original home is. And out of the 80 that were in attendance, I'd say probably 50 to 60 were also Willow's babies who all grown up. So to say it was emotional and a reunion of kind, it was just unbelievable. So I had to do it. It was like a mission. It was like, this is the way to finish this whole book enterprise, was to go back and honor her through this book by being in the vicinity. And then just really, literally just on the 23rd of March, just a week or so ago, 10 days ago, after many years of having this large placard made, but no place, the land where the home used to be was owned by somebody else, didn't want to have it commemorated. So finally, this large plaque on Grand Avenue in the center of Kansas City is a huge plaque, 8 foot high, 8 foot tall, 5 foot wide. People came from all of it and commemorated with a little story about the Willows and all the couple that started it and those of us who were graduated from it, so to speak. And so that was, I couldn't come back for that one, but it was, I had friends there. I got pictures of that. Even the daughter of the couple who's Carol Price, who's just a couple of years older than me, she's still there and still living in Kansas City. So really powerful, emotional, multiple layers of reunions, and not all of them happy. A lot of incomplete, a lot of frustration, which comes with adoption, searching for one's past through non-existent family trees, unsuccessful 23andMe, sealed records, a lot of frustration with a lot of people. And then, of course, there's always the surprise stories, people who never had a clue they were adopted until when they were about ready to get out of high school. Their folks said, well, there's something we should have told you in the beginning. You're adopted. Or I heard a guy on one of my other podcasts say that he was at his high school reunion, and you know, 25-year reunion, and a one of his former classmates came over and said, you know, I've always wanted to ask, what was it like to be adopted? He had no clue. No clue. Now, that's the surprise. Now, I have another one. I have a classmate.
How did the other guy know? How did the other guy know he was adopted?
I think the whole town knew except him. Other people held the secret. Now, this, I'll show you how this goes. In my own life, I'm pretty sure, I'll just talk about this hypothetically. There is a female classmate of mine who I went out with for a while and in a high school. And I knew she had a sister, but she was old, out of college, just older. Her parents were really old. You got old parents, so what? So my understanding is only recently did she find out that her mother that she grew up with is not her mother at all. Her so-called sister was her mother. So, but those stories are really common. I think it's in my book, there's about 1.5 million people like me who are formerly adopted. But if you include all the people who have been raised by somebody other than their biological parent or parents, that number goes up to 10 million. So a lot of people raised by grandparents, foster children, of course, members of the family, friends of the family who took somebody in, or in some cases in tribal circumstances where indigenous children are raised by others in the tribe that are not necessarily the parents but are still there. So that's where it exemplifies the idea that for every adoptee and all those of us who were raised by somebody other than our biological parents, there is an individual story for every one of us, and very few of them are the same. Of course, my book.
Let's say it's the 10 million, like, of people who are alive right now?
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, one of the books I've got a bunch of adoption books. One of them, guesstimates that the people who have been affected by adoption or know somebody who was adopted, maybe they weren't, or maybe they weren't, like me, a parent of an adopted child, that number can go up to 10 million. Now, I swear this is true. I can't go to a group of people and say six or seven and not ask the question, who here has been adopted, parent of an adopted child, or know somebody who's been adopted? And I'll usually get at least 2 out of 7. It's wow. Rare. It's rare to have somebody know or go, oh, yeah, like I got a cousin. He was adopted. Yeah, that's so-and-so. Oh, my neighbors across the street, they were adopted or they adopted a kid. It's so much more prevalent. We don't know this because I think I say in the book, we're an invisible community. We don't go around with a badge saying, guess what, I'm adopted. We don't know. It's not until we get to know somebody well enough and somebody who would actually share that, it becomes that secret gets exposed. Now, some people, it's not a moment of embarrassment or shame, but that's not true for everybody. Some people, there's a lot of the circumstances are something they don't want to know about or don't want others to know about. And in other cases, and I have a client right now who will prove this, sometimes in the search for our parents, birth parents, for those who are driven to, and not everybody is, sometimes we're not supposed to find them. Sometimes we shouldn't find them. I'm about 99.9% sure that at least one of the family members of one of my, well, I'll give you an example. So if his birth father wasn't Pablo Escobar, it was Escobar's brother. So he was adopted from Colombia. Pablo Escobar's picture on Wikipedia, my client at that same age are like, could be twins, but he was hustled out of the country and his birth mother was told that he had died and she had to get out of Dodge fast because both their lives were in jeopardy. So if you're a criminal and you don't want, you know, your love child to be known, it's not above a criminal type to have them killed. So there's a lot of that kind of, you know, sometimes you're just not supposed to know. Sometimes it's the business of the birth parents. It's their business why they got together and why they gave you up. And we adoptees can say, well, it's my right to know. But in fact, I think it's actually, well, arguably you can say it's still their right to keep their own secrets. And sometimes we shouldn't know those secrets.
So, okay, going back to the Willows, 30,000, yeah. Were they all adoptees? What did they do, any regular births with two parents, or this was
Kansas City in the 40s and 50s and 30s were considered, it was the hub of adoption in the United States. more homes and babies born, children born out of wedlock in homes for unwed mothers was because Kansas City is in the middle of the United States, and there's a lot of rail lines that go through there. So that's where, and they advertised, the founders advertised in magazines, national magazines all over the place. So they're very well known. And so there's a lot of confidence. It was kind of pricey. So it was going to keep some people from coming. Excuse me, one more second.
Wow.
So there's a steady stream of people coming in there. So young
from,
women
from all over the country, like
all over the
so
country.
If you were in New York, you got pregnant, your parents wanted to hide it, sent you to Kansas City.
Yeah, even better since you could go that far away. In the case of my birth mother, her hometown was maybe in those days by car, maybe 4 hours away. So, but it was still a ways away. Because particularly, well, any place at that time, I'll say, I don't think it's any more true in the Midwest, but you know, if you were a girl who was pregnant in town and with no boyfriend or husband to show for it, it was an enormous amount of shame and castigation. Kind of
Scarlet letter.
Scarlet letter. So you just simply go away for a while, and then you come back and
to your aunt's house. To your aunt Ida, who was failing.
Right. And by the way, also during this time, I don't have the figures in front of me, but I understand, particularly in the United States in the 50s, that in addition to adoptions being so popular, abortion was extremely popular. There were hot record numbers of abortions back in those days. Of course, this is before the pill, right? So it only makes sense. So this we're talking pre-internet, pre-pill days.
So this was before birth control.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was some kind of birth control, but
condoms probably, but right.
Yeah,
but,
that and there were maybe some other stuff for women, but not popularized and not safe necessarily. So,
but I mean, now if you take it, you know, when I used to play tennis, some of the high school girls in some of the towns had their babies watching them play, you know, like,
yeah.
I doubt they were married, but I guess I wonder when the stigma disappeared and when people had to stop hiding, you know?
Probably just a big rolling curve. I have no idea.
Yeah. But also, someone had said, I don't know if you ever heard of this book. I had another woman who was adopted on the show, and she said there was a book that she read. I don't remember the name, but it was based on the mothers. Instead of the children, the mothers who gave up the kids. And I don't know if it was then or 20 years later and the effect on them. I think most people think of the children, but not the cost of the mothers.
I don't think it's emphasized enough. And I think you're really right on the point. There's no reason to think that their sense of longing and having this, what I call in the book, a primal wound of separation of mother and child. Well, the mother is the half of the equation with the child on the other end. I mean, I know in fact that I know for a fact that, and she told me as much. I've had other people tell me who had other different powers to see into this that she she's regarded both as her great sacrifice, but of giving me up to a better life and not keeping me with her. But the price she paid was soon after marrying the wrong guy and being in an abusive relationship for a long time. And being in drug and alcohol addiction, I mean, her life went downhill fast after she gave me up. I'm not saying that's true for all women, but who gave birth to an unwanted child. But I think for a lot of them, you carry that weight of what you've done. And again, you could do it for all the right reasons. Say this was I do it again, but nevertheless, you're still heartache involved.
So I remember when you said, you know, you saw her pictures. She was this adorable little perky girl with energy and all that, and then she gives you up. She gets married to the wrong guy, has three kids. Boom. I mean, what do you think? I mean, I know you're a psychotherapist. Does she decide I'm no good? You know, like does she, and I, you probably can't say, but like, how does that take someone down the wrong? I mean, there was a girl who was a perky little cheerleader, you know, happy, happy, happy. She gets kicked off the squad for fighting. And boom, the next thing you know, she's a drug addict and ends up overdosing. But until that moment, and I don't know if this is true, this is the story I made up about her, that she decided she was no good. You know, something clicks in you, that little incident, and you make up a story and it takes you down. I don't know. What do you think about that? Well, you're the doctor. You're the PhD, not me, but yeah. It seems like that happened to your mom, you know?
Well, I would say, you know, using through that lens, particularly with a background in depth psychology or Jungian psychotherapy like me, that the things we think we want to attribute to what they thought and we're wrestling with consciously tend to be the opposite, tend to be held in the unconscious. You know, that the imprint of trauma is held deep within. Mm. It's not, you can walk around even till your midlife and kind of go, oh, this trauma of what happened to me is really in my guts. A lot of people don't even recognize that. Or to give a parallel example, let's shift out of adoption. Let's just say that you had an overbearing father. And let's say you're male, and I've had clients who are 70 years old, and the old man's been dead for 20 years. They're still trying to prove themselves to him. They're still the ghosts of those parents, or the old coach or whatever, the ghosts of them still rule your life. And you're not really aware of it. You don't quite know why, except for the fact that you haven't been able to wrestle with the fact that you were abandoned, you were, you know, shit on, pardon the French, by somebody who should have loved and taken care of you. Instead, they abandoned you and abused you. So you carry that around, and a lot of people think, well, I must have done something to deserve this, or I'm just no good anyway, otherwise no one would do that to somebody. So for whatever, beyond the rationale or the misconception, you carry that impact. It's a psycho-emotional impact, that scarring. And we can understand it more through the behavior we can see. In my case with clients, either people who have an enormous amount of hyperarousal, anxiety, ADD, obsessive compulsive, that on one hand, and on the other, depression, isolation, withdrawal. Both of those are responses to trauma. They're just two different sides of the same coin. But when you can see that in those behaviors, or in my case, I mentioned, for us adoptees, the sense of longing, to find home, of not being able to connect well over the years. I mean, I look at my own history and think, that's me. In the book, I say that I think if our adoption community had a theme song, it would be Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. How does it feel to be an unknown, a complete unknown, no direction home, like a rolling stone? But I'm mangling it a little. But that set, and when I mentioned that to that group in Kansas City, the room lit up. It's like they're going, yeah, that's me. That if I could open myself up, that's the inner self you would probably see. That's that. That's what I call about in our business, my business, the archetypal orphan, orphans all. Now, not everybody relates to that. I'm not challenging that, but that's how others. I know we got time here, so.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the commercial, and then we'll come back. I got some good questions about this, but I want to do that, and then. Then go forward. All right. So we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor, KokoriApp.com.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
So thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KokoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential social-emotional learning to your schools, change the lives of your students, have them connect, be more social, and feel way better about themselves, contact KokoriApp.com. It's doing wonders for schools, for businesses, for teams, really changes the dynamic in a very positive way. And as always, if you're not speaking up, if you feel like there's something you'd like to say, but you're just afraid, contact me. Go to realtalkwithhillary.com. You can get my book. It's got the Getting Real process for getting unstuck. And let's have a conversation. And now, welcome back, Steve Rowley. All right. So I have some questions about what you were just saying.
Okay.
So adoptees have this, you know, the archetypal orphan, subconscious trauma. Okay. Other people have other kind of trauma. Maybe they were, you know, abused or whatever. I know in one point of your book, you said you could be a victim, survivor, or hero. But if this is at the any of this trauma is at the subconscious level, how do you, as the psychotherapist, get to that? How do we? We don't, you know, it could be, we don't even know it's there. We don't know why we're doing what we're doing. Or it could be, you know, I had a family constellation guy. It could be trauma from a different lifetime, if you believe in that. Like, okay, so I'll be quiet. What's the answer?
Well, I'll try to condense 7 years of learning and give you a concise answer to your question. The way in which we do, first of all, in relationship to any client is creating a relationship that feels safe. If it doesn't feel safe, you're going nowhere. But the most important thing, I think, if there's a singular thing to point out, is having the person tell their story. Tell their adoption story, tell their abuse story, tell their victim story, tell their, how you were abandoned emotionally abandoned by your mother, even though you live in the same house, she never touched you, she never held you, and so forth. So tell that story and then tell it again. And in time, you begin to ways in suggesting how the facts, so-called facts, can remain the same, how we can begin to reframe the story. I think in your own book, it's a little like this. So let me just kind of push in farther. It's not the trauma is the killer. It's how we respond to trauma. And so I'll give you an example of where I'm going with this. Long time ago in Seattle, I was at some sort of self-growth workshop with 50 people, with two really well-known psychologists at the time. And they had us pair up, and we told each other our worst victim story, how you got screwed over by so-and-so and such-and-such. And they're pretty compelling stories. My partner and I were like, oh my God, yours is horrible. Oh, yours is terrible too. Okay. So they chose one woman to get up in front of all of us with her willing to do so and told her story. And her story was like lying in bed on a second story apartment with her baby in a basket next to her in bed. And the proverbial evil guy with a gigantic knife creeps into the room, climbs into bed with her, puts it up to her throat and says, either you're going to give yourself to me until I'm done or I'm killing you. I mean, she described it much more grand. I mean, it was horrible to hear the story. And when she was done, it's like the whole place was in tears. It was just like, well, that's the most outrageous, victim story you can possibly imagine. And I kept thinking, where are these guys going with this? I mean, it's a horror. What are you going to do with this? You can't change that. So one of them says, okay, now I want you to tell the same story, the same facts, but now I want you to and change your story from how I got almost killed by a rapist to how I saved my baby's life.
Mm.
Wow. At the moment he said that, you could just, the whole room shifted, and she had never thought of that. It's like, no, what you did was heroic. You could have done something stupid, got yourself and your baby killed, but you didn't. You saved your baby's life. You sacrificed for your baby. Now, that's a grandiose example of other ways in which we begin to alter the story, or that we have an attitude talking about my mom. Well, she was a wicked old witch, and, you know, she was abusive to me and my brothers and sisters, and she, you know, dominated by her father, and, you know, neighbors hated her and so forth. But on the other hand, she was always good for birthdays, and she always made a great birthday cake. So we have to come back and say, well, which version is it? Mm-hmm. Typical people will oftentimes one story or the other. It's an incomplete story. So one of the strategies, this is a Jungian concept of attention to the opposite, is to get a client or any of us doing this kind of work is to accept both as being true. She was both of these things. You can't just choose one or the other. But the thing is, in holding these tensions, that's not enough. Then we wait for what we call that, what we say the third, the resolution of that. And this is where I think we can't go make that happen in our heads. We can't cognitively work our way out of that puzzle. We have to wait and be patient to see how it will resolve itself and come back to us and tell us what's the new dialectic, the new resolution, a different way to look at this entirely. And those come at their own time. They're oftentimes unpredictable. And I tell clients, you know, something might come to you when you walk out the door. It might happen to you in a couple months. It might happen to you 3 years after we're done working together. But in some way, if you're patient and conscious that both of these are true, you'll find that other hidden gem that will have a different kind of meaning that will change your story and change your perspective on yourself. That's my story. I'm sticking to it.
No, I like it. But, you know, I think the first step is having a safe space to be able to say,
right,
tell their story without,
right,
judgment, without, you know, without feeling bad. And if you don't have, yeah, the right person, you go to someone else. I mean, I've had people who were not safe spaces, and
right,
you
have to be
stick with them. You know, like it didn't.
Yeah.
What just
the greatest? I think the greatest asset I think a therapist can have is curiosity.
Hmm.
To constantly question, constantly digging, trying to get through one layer to get to the other one. It's kind of like it's like dream work. I mean, sometimes the biggest message inside of a dream is some little obscure piece of it. Sort of like Where's Waldo. We're looking for clues. We're looking for things that have been outlook, things that the therapist, I can't predict what it's going to be, but suddenly a client will land on something, go, oh my God, now I see this completely different. Even in my own book, I think I have it in there, that the benefit of with my mother, so that I grew up, you know, my mom and dad, my mother, when my brother came, she was so, her attention was all for my brother, who was colicky and crying. I didn't took later to realize that the benefit of having my grandparents and aunt around for so long was I was being initiated into a kind of an elder consciousness. They taught me how to look, oftentimes non-verbally, but how to look and see the things around them without them necessarily being judgment. But it was more of an adult perspective. So it's kind of, by the time I was 10 or 12, I think I had my grandparents' perspective on the way the world worked and how to do business with people, and very different from my own mom and dad. So I was just lucky in that way. But that's a good example of how we, if we're lucky, we these tools are learning are around us all the time.
Hmm. Interesting. So what would you tell someone who did have trauma or who was adopted and who maybe they don't realize I know I was a victim until I did some transformational work. I didn't know I was a victim. I was a confused victim. That was my thing. Once I became aware of it, I could choose. I could look at it in a different way. But for these people who may not, maybe they're not aware that they're being a victim. But if they could go, oh, maybe I am, like, what could they do to get some power back and take their life back, perhaps?
It doesn't have to be with a therapist, but it does take some digging, you know, on one's own through artwork or writing or whatever, or even just simple simple reflection to say, I can't just go life through life thinking of myself as a victim, because it's a dead end street. So what? How do we get out of a dead end street? What changes our perception? How do we see the world differently because of, not in spite of, but because of the trauma? That's the head challenge. You know, because of the crappy things that happen.
Not because of, but in spite of. In spite of.
No, because we say, well, in spite of things, I overcame my obstacles. In spite of the obstacles, I became something. I'm saying because of the obstacles you had.
Okay.
So this is Dalai Lama 101, that obstacles are in fact the greatest adversaries, are our greatest teachers. You know, the hardship is the teacher. Moving out of ignorance is the teacher. You know, a state of grace, a positive state of grace, is like, okay, so you got, you know, God's grace, good for you. It feels great. But what about God's grace that comes to us in a really evil package, a ruthless package, or fierce packages? What about that? So the challenge is where, what's hidden in my story? What's hidden in myself that actually was the a hidden gift? For example, if I spent my time longing and feeling incomplete because of my adoption, what's the gift to that? that gift came to me on keeping me on a journey for a long time. Excuse me, one more time. This is allergy speaking.
Okay.
And it wasn't until I realized that longing was a sort of a plumb line into my own humanity. My sense of heartbreak and abandonment and loss taught me something about my heart.
So, I mean, I know it is an abandonment because you are abandoned as being adopted. You are abandoned by your mother, but is it always looked at as an abandonment if she did it for the right reason? I mean, yes. I mean, I guess it's how you frame it, right?
I think we all have to answer that question ourselves. Not all people think that that's the case. And who am I to say what they should feel or not, or that there's some kind of, you know, orphan archetype roaming around. Some people just say, hey, life's good. Why do I even want to find out anything? I'm happy. And I go, great, then don't. Then fine. But for those of us who are more curious, or those who have come to acculturated kind of a different sense of the self, that includes the conscious and cognitive self, the emotional self, but also the unconscious, that's a storehouse of memories, storehouse of trauma, storehouse of other deep hidden meanings that have capacity to illuminate the pathway when we're in a dark place, or if we're not in a dark place, simply illuminate our pathway into ever brightening stages of growth. All that's good and fine. So I would never try to speak for somebody else in that way, but I do think those who have that kind of, whether a therapist, not all therapists have that either, by the way, of course, but who do that, understand there are these other forces. Jung called, not only we have our personal unconscious, we have our collective unconscious. So we're joined in some other way with each other, if that's the right word. I'm not even sure that's the right word. That we share these archetypal impulses. We share in our common humanity. There's things we share with even the people who we find ourselves despising or making, casting them as demonic figures in the world. You know, with maybe exception of some totally, truly evil people, most of the people, even if they're a different religion and background and whatever, we share some common humanity with all of our brothers and sisters out there, I believe. Not everybody feels that. It doesn't matter the way they feel it. I just think it's true. And sometimes that's hard to reach. If you're, say, in the middle of the Middle East right now, it's darn hard to find compassion for the other side.
So, going back to the adoption, would you say, because I know in any, you know, whether you're adopted or something, it's the story Like, if we don't know the facts, it's easy to make up a story. It's easy for it to be disempowering. They didn't want me. Something's wrong with me. You know, when you, we'll just talk about you because you're the only one here. So when you found out the story, your mother, you know, was involved with, the guy was married, so she couldn't get married. And she wanted you to have a better life or something, if that's true. Did that give you some peace knowing why? Whereas some people may never find out why and they might put, you know, blame themselves.
It gave me quite a bit of inner resolution, but it didn't stop it. Even after I met my birth mother, even after I found out my birth father not too long ago, over the years, it quelled my curiosity to know more, as though there was something else I needed to know. So I have not been that inquisitive with my half sisters to know more, because it's like, well, now I feel like I'm just prying in your lives. Mm. And to what end? I mean, there's nothing more I need to know about me. That's why I ended the book that I did using this Zen koan to evoke the notion of mystery. And I think even the work as a psychotherapist, or even the look at our own lives, and some things are not explained. Mm. Sometimes we don't know why. You know, why did I meet my husband? Why did I meet my wife? Why did I go to the college I went to? Why was it I, you know, bumped into the profession I had? How did I back into this thing? I have no idea. And the fact is that there is that mystery element to it. And I think that's that kind of that invisible force of fate or destiny, that somehow it's with us. It's as though we're flowing down a raft on a river. Sounds like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. But you're on this river, and you can't be thinking about it all the time, but we are, in fact, in some kind of this motion, if you will, or state, where things are changing around us all the time. Now, is it always wind at our backs or in our faces? Maybe yes, maybe no. It's hard to say. But evoking that possibility as an imaginal possibility begins to, I think, gives a sort of ineffable element to what it means to be human, and what it means to be the nature of life is not a cognitive calculus. It's not an equation.
Not logical.
Yeah.
Logical or sequential, you know, it's not mathematical. It's not mathematical.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, maybe this is a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. There's your wife. Hi.
Oh, I'm online.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hello. Anyway, so let's just, this is a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it. I know for a person adopted, it's the worst. Not the worst thing. It's trauma. But there's other trauma. Let's say you have your parents and they abuse you, or they kill the other parent or something. Like, if you look at it that way, not that we get to choose, but it's all pretty bad, you know. And then it's a matter of, how are we going to write our story? Are we going to stay a victim? Are we going to stay powerless? Or how are we going to do that? But, you know, I always thought of orphans, or, you know, when you spent those 4 months in a place, who knows if you were ever hugged? Who knows? You know what I mean? We don't know.
Right.
It sounds terrible to me. But then there's other things as well that I hear people have gone through that are just as terrible. So not that you would want to choose, but do you ever think about that? And I know we got to wrap it up in 2 minutes. So
yeah. I'll make the distinction. In the book, I refer to this as a form of developmental trauma, which means it disrupts the normal flow of how one might ordinarily develop. Other kinds of developmental trauma would be bonding, or the lack of bonding, lack of good bonding. As those two compared with abject, emotional, physical, sexual kinds of trauma, they're a different kind, and oftentimes of a different degree.
Okay.
But the dynamics of toward healing are somewhat the same, but those are different. Have a more pointed moment or moments when these things happen that are so horrific what Winnicott refers to as primitive agonies. I mean, they're really the bad stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you see somebody murdered in front of you.
Yeah.
That evokes something that's going to have an impact. That's not developmental. That's just hard, cold trauma.
Right. So is the bonding, and I know we got to wrap it up, but I just want to ask, when someone like you maybe or maybe not didn't have the bonding because you were, I don't know, if when you did get adopted, if they were hugging and stuff like that, can you create the bonding from, I mean, is it just gone for the rest of your life?
I think the latter's true. I hate to admit it. It sounds like self-therapy here, but there's things you can do to accommodate to that.
Hmm.
You know, as though I've overcome. Now, it raises the issue in therapy. What's healing? What's integration? You know, all that. Those are big topics for another day.
Yeah.
But I think it's like, it's sort of like saying, well, if you got your leg blown off from your knee below your knee, you can learn to a prosthetic and you can live a great life with a prosthetic. Does that mean you've overcome the trauma? No, but you've learned to accommodate pretty darn well. It's not only a compensation, it may be an incredibly new compensation. You can't even begin to fathom yet. So.
Right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been so interesting. Thank you for letting me pick your brain and ask for that stuff. But what message would you want to leave the audience with? What would you be your vision in the next 5 years, or what do you hope to leave the world?
What I hope to leave the world?
Yeah. Like your impact. You know, answer it however you want. Something profound
I think the egoic part of me or other many people want to have big events, big accomplishments, public accolades, commonly acknowledged as being having done big things, good things, and all that stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. I mean, maybe we all have that, would like that ourselves. But I'd say that, you know, given the state of the world, it's more than enough to lead our lives with pursuing our own sense of personal integrity. And to use a coin from a word from your book, bullshit, is how do we live and cut through bullshit? How do we keep ourselves sane by seeing stuff that's ridiculous and nonsense and keeping in our own lane without thinking we have to change the world? We're like, oh, the high tech mogul, I'm going to change the world with my new device. You know, I just saw where, Reed Hastings, who is Netflix, he's buying a mountain resort and you have to have 100, the membership, not the property, just to be membership, to be on the top of the mountain. And your private exclusive ski resort is $100,000. I mean, it's doable. I mean, capitalism says you can do that, but to me, it's the ultimate, not the ultimate, but it's one of those excessive expressions of ego, not to mention the fact that we think we can own the mountains. We own the snow. This is mine. And I think I turn my back on that kind of stuff along. So I think leading pursuing our own kind of centeredness. I mean, if more people, if we're doing that, maybe our world would be a little bit better place to live in if we resolved around our own sense of personal integrity and justice for that matter. I mean, it's hacking, but I think that's to believe in that and to be a force for healing, not division. I think those are huge.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Stephen. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll get into more some deep stuff again sometime. So
okay.
Thank you.
All right, Hillary. Good luck to you.
All right. Okay. Don't leave. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.